The Honorable Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
You may be seated. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. You will notice that Justice Yvette McGee Brown is not with us physically this morning, but she will be participating in the decision-making of these cases. So we will start with 11-606, Paula Eastley versus Paul Holland Volkman, M.D. et al. Mr. Fons?
Yes. May it please the court, Jason Founds for the appellant, Denise Huffman, DBA Tri-State Healthcare. This case comes before the court today because the appellant was deprived, prevented from having a civil jury's verdict against her overturned on the manifest weight of the evidence based on the determination by one dissent in the 4th District Court of Appeals that sought to impose procedural requirements on her that don't exist under Ohio law. Well, normally a dissent's opinion wouldn't bring a case before the court. There's the unanimity requirement on a manifest weight of the evidence standard under the Ohio Constitution. So the dissent's opinion was, in effect, determinative of the issue before the court. Appellant doesn't dispute that there can be procedural requirements placed on a manifest weight of the evidence assignment of error on appeal. What she objects to is the fact that the court imposed new procedural requirements after the fact that don't exist under Ohio law. Simply put, there's nothing in the Ohio Constitution, Ohio Revised Code, the procedural rules, or the case law that requires the appellant to do what the dissent said she had to do in order to preserve her manifest weight of the evidence assignment of error on appeal.
So what are you asking us to do?
We're asking you to reverse the dissent's opinion, and which would result ultimately
in kind of an unusual request, because you want us not to reverse the decision of the majority of the appellate court. You want us to reverse a dissenting jurist.
Correct. I know it's an unusual request, but it's an unusual request.
Is there any precedent for that?
I don't know if the issue's precisely been raised before the court.
Did you research it?
Yes, I didn't see a case that had raised the issue before the court. But
I don't mean the issue. Did you research the notion of a Supreme Court reversing a dissenting jurist, sort of ordering one who holds to a view that you can't hold to the view?
The issue was researched, and I did not note the precedent in the court one way or the other.
Really, what you want us to do is look at the determination of manifest weight and make a rule of law that would say it is not necessary to file a predicate motion for new trial or judgment NOV as a predicate to raising a question of manifest weight in the appellate court. And if we did that as a matter of law, then the dissenting jurist would be bound by our decision. Is that what you want us to do?
Basically, I guess in a nutshell, yes, Your Honor. That's what we're asking the court to do. That's the rule we'd like the court to come up with.
What is your strongest authority that we should make a rule like that?
Well, the strongest authority, I think, is the fact that there simply is no authority anywhere that says you have to do any of these things in order to preserve a manifest weight of the evidence assignment of error on appeal. There has to be some basis. If you're going to require a party to file to do certain things in order to preserve a right to a certain assignment of error on appeal, there has to be some basis for those requirements. You got to find it somewhere. It's got to be in the statutes. It's got to be in the procedural rules, the Constitution, the case law. There's all kinds of opportunities for the courts or for the legislature to impose the requirements, and it simply hasn't been done before. In fact, if you look at the motions for directed verdicts and the motions for judgment J and OV, the issue has never, from as far as I can tell, from the cases that have been cited, it's never been raised before that there was some sort of a prerequisite that you had to file a directed verdict motion or a motion for judgment, JNOV.
Was this an issue raised by your opposing counsel, or was this something that the judge seemed to have come up with on her own?
This was something the judge came up with on his own.
Mr. Fons, I'm still confused. As you know, we reverse judgments. We don't reverse opinions. And in this particular case, the court has done what with respect to the judgment, and what do you ask us to do with respect to that judgment?
We would like for the court to come forth with a decision that says that none of these, you don't have to file a motion for a new trial, a motion for a directed verdict, or a motion for judgment, JNOV, in order to preserve a manifest weight of the evidence, assignment of error. I believe that would that results, and I would also believe that the court should reverse the dissent's opinion. I know it's an unusual.
Don't reverse an opinion.
Okay.
And the judgment was to affirm the trial court's judgment in part, reverse it in part, and remand for further proceedings consistent with this opinion. That's what the judgment was of the Court of Appeals.
Okay. Perhaps I'm using the wrong terminology then. Mm-hmm. We would like the decision to be reversed because, sorry.
if we reverse the judgment and send it
right
back for the court to reconsider manifest weight without that prohibition that the judge has self-imposed, that would get you to the same part place, wouldn't it?
It would, but if you look at the way the dissenting opinion wrote, the dissenting opinion is structured, it doesn't decide that the case was not against the manifest weight of the evidence. It decides that, no, it's this procedural issue. I guess
right, and if we remove the procedural issue, then that judge is now free. If we have reversed the judgment, the judge is now free to consider the manifest weight with our instruction that this is not a prohibition on your considering manifest weight.
Absolutely, Your Honor. That would be one of the potential results. The result we would prefer would be that the judgment be reversed and that judgment be entered in favor of our client.
Well, we could reverse the judgment and say you lose on the manifest weight question. How would that be?
I don't think I'd like that. but I don't think that would be the ultimate result of the court's decision. I'm not sure how the court would get there. I don't know how you would reverse it on the manifest weight of the evidence because the merits of the manifest weight of the evidence aren't necessarily before the court today. What's before the court is what the dissenting judge did in imposing these requirements. So I'm not sure if the court could rule that the case was not against the manifest weight of the evidence.
Or we could agree with the dissenting judge that you have to make those motions at the trial.
You could. I don't think there's any basis for making that decision. But obviously, that's an option for the court.
Did you find other appellate courts that adhere to the analysis offered by Judge Klein in the dissenting opinion?
No, Your Honor, I did not. If you're looking at there's basically three types of motions: the Civil Rule 59, the motion for a new trial, based on the manifest weight of the evidence. There was one decision that's been discussed so far, which is Gonzalez versus Henceforth. It's out of the Ninth District. The court rejected the argument that the dissent made.
Did your research disclose any prerequisite to raising a manifest weight of the evidence challenge in an appellate court?
No, not in like the pretrial or post-trial motion context. Obviously, you have to meet your filing deadlines and the typical procedural requirements that any party is going to have to meet on an appeal.
What about sufficiency? Do you see the two as the same, or do you see them as different standards, manifest weight and sufficiency of evidence?
I know the court has said that those two concepts tend to merge, but I know the court
has
also...
Which court has said that?
I'm sorry?
Which court has said that?
The Supreme Court, State versus Wilson, said that the concepts tend to merge. However, I believe there was a comment in the DeMonco case a few years ago by the court where it noted that there are still two different standards that are being applied.
Does that need to be clarified?
It would be good because I think there's some confusion amongst the appellate courts about which standard applies and how the standard should be enforced.
Thank you.
The at the trial, the insufficiency of the evidence is what? You're here representing the woman that owned this.
Yes.
Institution.
Yes.
Pain clinic, I guess we call it.
Yes.
She's not a doctor.
No.
What's the level of her education?
I believe she has a high school education.
Okay. So how are you ever going to, how's anyone ever going to establish negligent supervision of a doctor by somebody who's got a high school degree, or maybe not even that?
I'm not sure negligent supervision would have fit under these circumstances. If you look back in the procedural history of the case, what they started with was a traditional medical malpractice with the Clark v. Southview agency by estoppel theory. They amended the complaint. Mostly they dropped that theory to go with a regular negligence theory, and they did so not explicitly, but I believe tacitly, in order to fit it under insurance coverage. So they were trying to tailor their complaint to get it under the coverage, which is an issue that the court has declined, appellate court determined there was no coverage, and this court refused to extend jurisdiction to hear that issue. Okay. When it comes to, there are some practical implications too of if the court were to adopt the dissent's opinion. I think these are most readily apparent when it comes to the motions for a new trial. There are a number of grounds listed in Rule 59 for a motion for a new trial. You have procedural irregularities, you have legal issues, legal errors, errors of law, and then there's the catch-all provision at the end of the rule, which permits a trial court to order a new trial based on his or her sound discretion and for good cause shown. One of the practical implications, I think, of adopting the dissent's opinion, at least as it relates to the Rule 59 motion for a new trial, is that any party who has any of those grounds now under Civil Rule 59 that they anticipate raising later on appeal, now they're going to be bringing those in a motion for a new trial. Because even though the court's opinion would maybe only address the manifest weight of the evidence standard, it's going to raise some ambiguity, and we know what the careful lawyer is going to do when there's ambiguity. If I don't know if I'm supposed to do 1, 2, or 3, you're darn well sure I'm going to do 1, 2, and 3, just to make sure I've got all my bases covered.
Well, isn't it unusual to make a motion for a directed verdict at the end of the plaintiff's case and not renew that at the end of your own case?
It is unusual.
So we're dealing here with a train wreck because a lawyer didn't make the standard motion at the end of the case.
I think we're dealing with this issue because the dissent sort of lost their way in drafting their opinion.
Well, didn't the defense attorney lose his way when he was trying the case if he didn't make that motion?
It should have been made, Your Honor. There's no question about it. But if you read the dissent's opinion, we'd still be dealing with the motion for JNOV, and we'd still be dealing with the motion for a new trial. So I think we'd ultimately have ended up in the same place.
Well, isn't the theory that you clean up any messes created at trial on the trial level if you can? And isn't that what the JNOV and the new trial would do?
Those are options for a party to be able to.
Well, they're options, but they're preferred course of conduct at the end of a trial, so you're not, burdening the appellate court with everything that happened at trial unnecessarily.
That's accurate, Your Honor. But the manifest weight of the evidence is sort of a unique assignment of error. It's one of the few you're actually going to find in the constitutional provision, and it's traditionally been treated as sort of a I don't know if the bright word would be a fail-safe necessarily for juries who simply lose their way in making their determination. It allows the court to look at it.
Well, that again would point to the trial judge then being the individual, the entity by law who's in charge of the trial. And if the jury does lose their way, for whatever reason, the fail-safe there is the judge.
Right, but there's two different standards that get applied. The motion for a directed verdict is applying what it amounts to a motion for summary judgment standard, determination of law on the sufficiency of the evidence. It's a different standard when you're dealing with the manifest weight. You're not dealing with what the trial judge determined. You're dealing with what the jury did with the evidence after they received the case. So I think they're two different processes, two different analyses. They get different treatment by the appellate court on appeal.
Well, but the judgment NOV would fill that gap then.
Well, the judgment, the JNOV motion, a judgment, it's going to apply the same standard as the motion for directed verdict. So if you've moved for a directed verdict and you've renewed it and it's been denied, then you're going to come back with the same motion after the trial.
But in this case, none of the motions were made.
No.
At the end of trial.
That's correct, Your
Honor. Even though they were made at varying stages during trial.
Right. There was a motion for directed verdict that was made, and it was not renewed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. The appellee has waived oral argument. We will take the matter under advisement, and you'll be notified of our decision. Thank you.